I was asked to talk with you a little while about Christians dealing with mental illness. When we talk about mental illnesses, we're referring to a group of brain disorders that cause severe disturbances in thinking, feeling, and relating, often to the point where there's an inability to cope with the ordinary demands of life. Mental illnesses exist throughout the world, in every culture, in every country, regardless of custom, race, religion, economic condition, regardless of child-rearing practices or political orientation. We've been trying to understand mental illness for centuries with only limited success. People suffering from mental illnesses have experiences that are quite different from most of the rest of us. Sometimes they can't distinguish reality from their own fantasies. Sometimes their perceptions of the world are grossly distorted. Sometimes their moods swing dramatically from one extreme to another. And when these symptoms persist in a severe and disabling way for long periods of time, we consider these to be caused by two groups of conditions that are psychiatric conditions. There is schizophrenia, and major affective disorders. These two are the most serious forms of mental illness. Schizophrenia is the worst of the mental illnesses, the major affective disorders like bipolar disorder, and also severe depressive disorder. These are a little bit different from the one on the other side, the schizophrenia. The major affective disorders can be quite disabling, but they deal with disturbances of mood. Over here, it's an issue of mood. Schizophrenia deals with disturbances of thought. And actually, I should put these schizophrenias, because like there are many forms of cancer, there are many kinds of schizophrenia. If you look in a medical textbook, often there will be a chapter on the schizophrenias. Schizophrenia is a thought disorder because its symptoms have to do with disturbances in thinking. There are common symptoms in all the different kinds of schizophrenia. They respond to certain treatments, but although they have predictable courses and outcomes that are generally alike, there's still a lot of differences, so we have to distinguish between one kind and another. Just because two people have schizophrenia doesn't mean that they're a lot alike. If somebody is in a psychotic stage of this disease, it can be expressed through things like hallucinations. And delusions. Hallucinations are sensory experiences that are not based on any external reality. The most common hallucination for an unmedicated schizophrenic is just hearing voices that don't really exist. They can also see things that aren't there. They can smell things and feel things that aren't there. But the main thing is the voices. And these things seem just as real to them as sitting here in this room seems right now to you. The voices may be insulting. They may be demeaning to the person hearing them. They may tell the person to do things. Sometimes they may cause the person to smile or laugh for no apparent reason, not apparent to the rest of us. Now, a delusion is a false belief. Many people with schizophrenia believe that the people on the television are talking directly to them. People with paranoid schizophrenia typically believe that other people are trying to harm them. Many have delusions with religious themes. To discuss the Bible with somebody who's in active schizophrenia And here their understanding of a certain Bible passage can be quite a bizarre experience, mighty bizarre. If a schizophrenia, a person who's afflicted with this, happens to be holding two contradictory delusions at the same time, you're probably not going to talk him out of either one of them. You may get this far to say, can you see how these contradict with each other? If one is true, the other can't be true. And to say, yeah, I can see that, but I still believe them both. You're not going to talk them out of it, at least not ordinarily. Schizophrenics are overstimulated by their own internal chaos. Some of them react by withdrawing into their own quiet space. They feel confused and overwhelmed, and especially when they're around people, this is true, and in particular when they're around large groups of people. Sometimes they feel like their life is spent walking in a dream, and things are happening without the usual logical progression that most of us experience. I don't know if you can remember a movie that came out a number of years ago. Some of you saw it, I think. It was called A Beautiful Mind. This was a book also, but the movie version was quite popular. It was an account of the life of the schizophrenic mathematician named John Nash. Russell Crowe, the actor, played the part of John Nash. But I read the book a number of years ago, and I found it to be much better than the movie, and also much more accurate about his life than the movie was. The statement was made in that book, A Beautiful Mind, that Kafka's novel, The Castle, is probably the most compelling rendering of the schizophrenic consciousness in all of literature. Now, a lot of you in the room have probably read something by Franz Kafka. I think The Metamorphosis used to be assigned in school, and maybe still is. It's very likely that there are people here who have read The Metamorphosis. The protagonist in that novel, or short novella, he woke up one morning to find that he had been transformed into a giant insect. That's typical of the first sentence of that novel, and it goes on from there. So you may have read that. You may have read The Trial or The Penal Colony or some of the short stories of Kafka. I mention that because everything Kafka wrote is related. But when he died in 1924, he left behind the novel The Castle, which was unfinished. He left also instructions saying that everything, all his writings should be burned, but they weren't. And The Castle was published a couple years later, and it is a pretty bleak book. It's a very odd book, but it's supposed to be similar to the schizophrenic experience. I can see why the author of A Beautiful Mind would call it a rendering of the schizophrenic consciousness. In the major affective disorders, the main symptoms have to do with disturbances of mood, as I said. Moods are disturbed if they are too up. That's the manic part. Bipolar used to be known as manic depressive. They don't call it that anymore because people were getting confused. They were confusing the manic with maniac, and they didn't want maniac in the word, so they changed it to bipolar. But it's the same thing that used to be called manic depressive disorder a few years ago. The manic part is when you're way, way up, and the depressive part, of course, is when you're way down. And sometimes there's a lot of disruption when they alternate between the two. With bipolar, people have episodes of feeling manic that may go on for quite some time. This is very individualized. And then the opposite of that is when they feel depressed. But in the depressive disorder down here, severe depressive, they only have the low end, just the depressive part. Both the bipolar and severely depressive people have periods when they their moods are relatively normal as well. So patterns vary enormously from one person to another as far as how long these episodes last or how frequently they occur, but regular patterns will develop with each individual. Individuals differ so much in these things that it's hard to talk generally about this subject. But we're not talking here about things that we see around us just every day and all the time in most cases, unless you live with somebody like this. Most of us know people that we would consider moody, for example. But this is far different from them having an affective disorder. To have that, the moods must be extreme. The depression must be so severe that eating and sleeping patterns are seriously disturbed. or the person is so lacking in energy, so lacking in interest that they can just barely do anything at all. Feelings of worthlessness, hopelessness, helplessness, haplessness abound. Severely depressed people may have tremendous difficulty in concentrating, hard time making decisions. They may feel so bad that they're thinking about suicide. In fact, 10% of people with schizophrenia and severe bipolar disorder, in fact, do ultimately purposefully end their own lives. Depression can reach a psychotic level with feelings that lead to delusions as well, believing things that aren't true, thinking that your thoughts can injure other people, for example, thinking that you were responsible for a tornado, thinking that you were responsible for a car wreck in which someone was killed, even though you were miles away at the time. These are really serious issues for people who have these problems. On the other hand, people who are in a manic state, the manic part of the bipolar condition, have moods that are so elevated that they often do inappropriate things. They talk extremely fast, they're pressurized, their thoughts race from one idea to another, don't sleep much, their eating patterns may change. They often spend lots of money whether they have it or not, easily distracted, they may have grandiose delusions, believing that they're superhuman or have special powers. What causes mental illnesses and who is likely to get them? Well, until recently, ways of studying the brain were quite limited. The main thing we could do was perform autopsies on the brains of cadavers, and that wasn't very helpful because obviously it's hard to study how the brain works when it's already dead. But now we can do MRI scans, we can do PET scans, and we can actually make three-dimensional pictures of living brains while they're involved in various activities. And we can see the differences in functioning in the brains of normal people compared with people who have the brains of people who have schizophrenia or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, and the list goes on and on. Genetics has helped us here a great deal. We have located the chromosomes and genetic markers in people with bipolar disorder, and we can actually trace them on family trees. So we're learning. Nevertheless, what we don't know about mental illness far outweighs that which we do know about it. Some of you know that Lynn and I have a son who is afflicted with schizophrenia. When we first got that diagnosis years ago, I thought, well, if we can learn everything there is to know about schizophrenia, maybe we can fix it. But part of the learning was that almost nothing is known about schizophrenia. These are the most complicated problems in medicine because they deal with the brain. That makes them far more complicated than diabetes or heart disease. Nobody knows exactly what causes mental illnesses, and worse, nobody knows how to cure them, and nobody knows how to predict in whom they will develop. But we do know now that heredity is the most important factor in determining who is likely to develop them. The evidence for this is quite substantial. The chance of your getting schizophrenia depends on how many and which of your relatives had or have it. If nobody in your family has ever had schizophrenia, then you have a 1% chance of getting it. That's the occurrence in the general population around the world, 1%. Doesn't matter if you're in a developed country or an undeveloped country, 1% around the globe, regardless of child-rearing practices or religion or socioeconomic status or race or political system or any other variable, 1% around the globe. From between 2 and 3 million Americans have schizophrenia at this time. Many more than that suffer from bipolar and severe depressive disorders. Here's an interesting thing, speaking of schizophrenia. If a second degree relative of yours has it, like a first cousin or a grandparent, if they have it, you have not a 1%, but a 2% chance of getting it. If a first degree relative has it, like a parent or a brother or sister, you have a 10% chance of getting it. If both your parents have it, you have a 40% chance of getting it. If you have an identical twin who has it, you have a 50% chance. If several relatives have it, you add up the percentage that go with each relative and come up with the conclusion that you have a parent has it, one parent has it, that would be 10%, and one cousin has it, that would be 2%. So you'd have a 12% chance of getting it. Not only are these things true, but we've followed for some time the histories of children whose biological parents had schizophrenia and who were adopted. The children were adopted by people who did not have schizophrenia. On the converse of that, we have followed the histories of adopted children who were born to non-schizophrenic parents but adopted by people with schizophrenia. And the outcome statistics here heavily favor biology and not environment as the cause. 10% of those born to a parent with schizophrenia developed the illness even though they were raised by normal parents. 1% of those born to normal parents and raised by parents with schizophrenia developed the illness. Exactly the same as in the general population. Studies of identical twins who were adopted and raised separately in different families, sometimes far from one another, show the same thing. 50% of those whose twin developed schizophrenia developed the illness themselves. So we know that there is a physiological factor here. And we know that the primary cause of bipolar and severe depressive disorder is physiological and genetic. We have a lot of evidence along the genetic line. We also have considerable evidence about what does not cause mental illness. In the past, many families have thought that maybe alcohol or drugs cause their relative to develop mental illness. There are millions of people who abuse drugs and or alcohol and never develop any signs of schizophrenia or a major affective disorder. Many people, what happens oftener, I think, is many people who are starting to have symptoms of mental illness and get afraid, frightened by this, confused by it. They will turn in self-medication to drugs or alcohol to try to get away from their discomfort or from the fear of what is happening to them. Here they're locked in a body. They know something's wrong, but they don't know what it is. They don't really want to admit it. Maybe they go into their closet and cry out to God and ask why, and they just often do not know what to do or where to turn. Now, does God cause mental illness? The answer to that is an absolute no. Was there schizophrenia in the Garden of Eden? We know that there wasn't because schizophrenia is not good. And God looked at everything that He'd made in Genesis 1:31 and said, it's very good. There was no schizophrenia there at the time. What we do know, though, is that there are over 1,500 harmful genetic mutations in our gene pool, directly and indirectly brought about by man. Sometimes they were brought about because of human sin in one way or another. Other times it wasn't sin, but just poor judgment or uninformed judgment. We filled our school buildings with asbestos. We painted our houses with lead paint. We dumped Agent Orange on our soldiers. We spread DDT all over the ground. We gave thalidomide to pregnant women. And we can go on and on and on. God didn't cause these things, but He allows the results to ensue. God does not cause mental illness, but God loves everybody who is mentally ill. And while there is no known cure for these serious mental illnesses, what we can do for many people is reduce the severity of their symptoms and often improve the quality of their life through the use of medication. This is something that God has given us and that is very important when we talk about this subject. The most significant consideration, and I'm assuming that we're Christians, I'm assuming that we're praying and talking and all the things that we should do around these cases, but the most significant consideration after all that is which medicine to try first. Unfortunately, the only way to tell which treatment is going to help the most is through trial and error. I don't know of any other way than that. Why some people are helped by some treatments and others are not is just not known, and nobody can predict who will or won't be helped by a certain treatment. Success in that is probably related to individual physiological differences that we don't know very much about yet. And it can take years to get the right combination of medicines in the right dosages. And even then, when you got it right, things can change as the body becomes used to the drugs or because of the progression of the disease. So you have to have constant monitoring here. But I stress to you that the single most effective form of treatment for most people with a major mental illness is medication. 80% of schizophrenics are helped by medication, at least to some degree. And the affective disorders on the other side of the board tend to respond to medication even better than schizophrenia does. If a person has a major depression or bipolar disorder, they have a good chance of being helped by by medicine and being helped a lot by medicine. In fact, many people with these major affective disorders live very full lives. They can work, they can have families and friends, they can enjoy themselves, and they're able to do almost everything that they would like to do. Many people with whom they have contact have no idea that they're taking medication and have no idea in many cases that they even suffer from a serious mental illness because it's so well controlled by the medication that they're taking. 80% of people with bipolar disorder find that medicine either completely eliminates or at least minimizes the mood swings that they have so that they can handle them. Now, remember this. Jesus said that sick people need a doctor. And needing a doctor includes needing the medication that the doctor prescribes. We should thank God that He has allowed us to isolate and discover these medicines, such as we have them now. Maybe they will improve in the future. We hope so. But they're better now than they were even a generation ago. And previous generations didn't have any of these. They had to lock their mentally ill relatives up to keep them from hurting themselves. When Patrick Henry said, "Give me liberty or give me death," his own wife was at home in chains because there was no treatment known for her condition. So we've come a long way in the last couple hundred years. We've come a long way in the past few decades. Although it's still true that prescribing medicine for people with mental illnesses is far from an exact science. More often than not, it's a kind of a hit or miss process. That didn't work, we'll try this. But the biggest problem we face is getting people to just take their medicine. Many will take it for a while, and over time then they do start feeling better. But when they feel better, they'll say, "Well, I don't need that anymore. I feel just fine. Maybe it did help a little bit. I feel fine now. Not going to take it anymore." A lot of people don't like the side effects of the drugs, and I can only imagine because I've never had to do this myself, so I feel for these people. They don't like the feeling of lethargy that comes sometimes as a side effect, or sleepiness, or there are all kinds of side effects. Tardive dyskinesia, all different sorts of things that can happen to you when you use these drugs. Or they'll say, "I just don't feel like myself when I'm taking this drug. It makes me feel funny." And many begin to feel that the benefit does not justify the side effects that they're feeling. Because people want to feel normal, especially young people, just want to feel normal. Like a nurse said to me one time in an institution, he wants to be a normal 21-year-old, and he's just not. And, you know, it's hard to accept that. You want to deny it for as long as you can. So you've been taking the medicine for a couple months, you feel pretty good, you lay it aside, you take yourself off the medication, and you go right back to where you were before you started on the medication. So these people and their families and friends who are trying to help them stay on this roller coaster. Take the medicine for a while, get better, quit the medicine, get worse. Go off the medication, and a couple months later they feel like they're losing their mind or they're thinking about killing themselves again. So they go back in the hospital and back on the medicine and climb back up the hill all over again. It's extremely difficult for many people to accept that they have a mental illness. They go into denial, which is the usual reaction that all of us have to shocking bad news, is to deny it. Somebody tells us something shocking, "Well, are you sure?" Well, maybe they're pretty sure. You know, they usually are if they're telling you something that extreme. But we'll say, "Are you sure? Oh, that can't be right." You know, that's denial. And we can understand why somebody would deny interiorly, no matter what they're saying outwardly. I'm going to beat this thing. I don't think they're wrong. I don't think they're right. That's a bad diagnosis. They grieve the loss of some of their dreams. They grieve the loss of the ability to have a normal life. Accepting that you have a mental illness often means acknowledging that your life is going to be quite a bit different than you had hoped that it would. Some people believe that they can survive without treatment. Some people think that if I can just survive without taking the treatment, then that proves I'm not really crazy. That proves I'm not really a mental case after all. So there are all these things that enter into this and why it's hard for people to take the drugs that are prescribed for them. The topic assigned to me for tonight is Christians dealing with mental illness. The mental illness may be your own mental illness, or it very often may be the mental illness of someone you love. Maybe a member of your family, maybe somebody close to you, maybe somebody in the church. I think the main thing we need to do here, this is very general but very important, is just apply the good old golden rule. Treat them like you would want to be treated if your roles were reversed. Treat them with respect. Listen very carefully to them. The sick person needs to know that people are taking his or her concerns seriously. Obviously, before a person can take medication, they have to be willing to talk to a doctor who is the only person who can prescribe it. Just getting somebody to go to a doctor sometimes can be a very challenging thing. So get the name of a doctor who's good at dealing with mental illness by asking people who've had a friend or relative who's been treated for a similar condition. Maybe ask somebody in the medical field who they would send their own family member to. There are online resources for finding a good doctor as well. Medical fields, like most fields, like carpentry or auto mechanics, there's a lot of mediocre ones. There's a few good ones. So you want to find the good one. It's good for a doctor to have had experience with the specific kind of illness with which the person is suffering. Ask them if they have worked with people who have your relative's specific condition, and if so, how extensively have they worked with that. It's good and very important for there to be as good a rapport as possible between the doctor and the patient, because the patient needs to do more than just present their body there. They need to talk and tell the doctor about thoughts and feelings that they're having. If you don't trust the doctor, then it would be hard to do that. You don't want a doctor who will expect either too little or too much from the patient. They need to expect just the right amount, and they figure that out based on the experience that they have had. We want some expectations, but we want those expectations to be reachable so there can be victories and success rather than just failure all the time. I think it's hard to overemphasize how important early detection of these illnesses is. Sometimes it takes a long time. You think about people, well, is it really this or is it that? Are they just acting this way? Or is this just bad behavior? Or is this something more than that? You go through a long process sometimes to figure all that out. But once you're sure they have one of these mental illnesses, the earlier they start the medication, the better. Never trivialize in your comments to them the discomfort that's caused by the side effects of the medicine, but try to point out the benefits of taking the medicine. By the way, we have other medicines to try to alleviate the side effects of the antipsychotic medicine. So it's an art to get those things construed in the right kind of way. If a person is taking medicine, create a way for that person to know every day when to take their medicine and whether or not they indeed have already taken it that day. Some of these medications come now in a long-acting injectable form where a person just gets a shot once or twice a month, and then they don't even have to worry about taking that medication for the rest of the time. Somebody else injects it into their leg or whatever. An illness of this variety that begins later in life may be less severe than the ones that start early, but unfortunately most of these start relatively early. Schizophrenia most commonly begins in late adolescence or early adulthood. For boys, it's usually earlier than for girls. For boys, there is usually an adolescent onset starting in the late teens or early 20s. Our son Dylan was here with me for your whole two-week meeting in 1997. He was already deteriorating, stayed out at Lowell's house. He was already deteriorating at that time, but we didn't know why, and he didn't know why. He knew that he didn't feel quite right. We knew that already that he wasn't like he used to be, but we had no idea what was apparently really going on. Late teens or early 20s is when it starts with boys. For girls, it's usually mid-20s or sometimes even early 30s. A lot of you know Eldon Cox. Many of you knew his first wife. She was a schizophrenic, but it didn't come on her until she was 30 years old. Bipolar can appear at any age, but it's likely to be more severe if it appears in adolescence or early adulthood. And unfortunately, that's when it often does appear. Few people develop bipolar disorder after the age of 35. The prognosis for these diseases is usually better if the symptoms begin suddenly. The illness is likely to be more severe when the symptoms begin very gradually over a long period of time. But the assignment I've been given is, how do we deal with these things? How do we deal? How do Christians deal with mental illnesses? Whether it's yours or somebody else's, how do you deal with it? One of the things we need to do is to learn to make peace with whatever limitations these illnesses impose on the lives of our loved ones or on our own lives. It's not like we have much choice, after all, since there's no known cure. We need to learn to enjoy whatever good times there can be. We need to learn to appreciate the abilities that still remain intact. And we need to try to feel good about any steps that are made in a positive direction. God never expects you to do more than you can, so we can all feel good about that. We need to allow people as much freedom and as much responsibility as they can handle. This includes their work in the church. Some rather severely afflicted, mentally ill people have periods where they can still work or even work publicly in the church. If it can't be publicly for men, then sometimes it'll be something else that they can do to be a part of the family of God to the extent that they are capable of functioning in that manner. Recognize that these people, though, are not always the best judge of how much freedom and responsibility that they themselves should have. Mental illnesses are different from other illnesses in this respect. When people, what people do, for instance, in the midst of a psychotic break, they don't always remember. Your feelings may be hurt by things that they say or by things that they do, but if they were psychotic at the time, sometimes they don't even know what it was that they did. So try to keep the long-term picture in mind. Try to protect your own health. Understand the need to create some distance between yourself and this other person at times, especially perhaps if it's a family member. It takes a lot of people years to really accept that their loved one has a mental illness. Just as it can take years for people who have it to accept it, it can take years for family members to accept that this is really what's going on. But I think until you can accept this, you won't be able to be supportive in the way that you need to be. If you keep on and keep on and keep on trying to get the person to snap out of it, everybody's going to wind up frustrated if it's really a mental illness. So do everything possible to keep the unpredictability of the symptoms from wreaking havoc in your life and the lives of other people. These illnesses take an enormous toll on everybody, and sometimes it can be hard not to take the symptoms personally. But when you're tempted to take a symptom personally, I think you should just think of a baby that burps up on your shoulder when you're jiggling it. You know, you're standing around after church, somebody hands you a baby and it's on your shoulder and it burps up on your shoulder. Think of it like that. Is the baby bad because it burped up on your shoulder? Is the baby spiteful? No, you just happen to be there, that's all. And this is much the same kind of a situation. Look at these things, or try to look at these things, from the ill person's point of view. Many of their same age friends, if this has gone on for years, many of their friends of the same age have gone on to accomplish things that the ill person may never be able to do. So we want to comment on any small signs of progress that we can see. Comment on any small improvements that have been made. Things in life that the rest of us take easily for granted can be monumentally difficult for people with a mental illness. Even walking into a room with people in it can be a huge struggle for some of these people. Even looking somebody in the eye can be something that's just almost impossible to do. Or allowing yourself to be touched by somebody. Everybody needs to have goals, but whatever the goals are for this person, they need to be realistic. And once you pare down your expectations to what is really realistic, then you can better see and appreciate the accomplishments that are made when they are made. Let people do as much as they can to care for themselves. Try to ensure that they feel your love and support, but also establish a loving distance. Family members often get polarized around this issue of just how involved to be in the life of this person. But if they are an adult, they need to be treated as an adult as much as they can be treated as an adult. So often we need to take the family members and find an appropriate middle ground in their approaches. And all this is decided given the person's current level of functioning. People with mental illnesses need structure in their lives. The chaos and disorganization of their internal world needs a steadying influence on the outside. So we do what we can to provide a calm external reality that's consistent and predictable. They need to know what to expect from you, and they need to know what you expect from them. And I'm talking about a simple daily routine, especially if they live with you, which is often the case. A simple daily routine. One night I was in the hospital in the middle of the night because a man had had an emergency with his heart and was having to have surgery right away, and his Down syndrome daughter was there. And she had a daily routine that she followed to the letter, you know. And her concern in the emergency room waiting room was that I'm not in bed. I'm supposed to be in bed right now. And she couldn't understand why anything was being allowed to interfere with the fact that she was supposed to be in bed. We got some blankets from the nurses and put her on the couch, and she was fine. But there's nothing blameworthy here. This is just what she is capable of. It's a simple daily routine that she needs, and she has it, and she wants to stick to it. And people with mental illnesses are often similar. It's not that they want the routine necessarily, but they need the routine, and the routine will help them. And it may help to even put these things in writing. You might want to have the person write out a contract if they're able to do that. This is especially true if they live with you. Establish the consequences for breaking a rule in advance, and try to make the consequences relate to the rule to which they pertain. In other words, make the punishment fit the crime. Consult the person when you're deciding early on what the consequences will be. Don't try to develop consequences in the middle of a crisis. Do this all in peaceable times. It's important that everybody knows what the rules are and what will happen if the rules are not followed. And then follow through on what you said. Your credibility obviously depends on that. The more we understand about how people with mental illnesses process information, which is different from the way you and I process it, then the better we can communicate with them. Sometimes my wife has compared our son's thinking to a slow computer sometimes. Not always that way, but sometimes. She said it's like a slow computer. You know, ask him something, and then a while later you get the answer. So be simple. And it's not that he's unintelligent. He's as smart as everyone. He may be the smartest one of my three children. He's still in there. But yet he's got this husk of mental illness surrounding him also. So be simple, be brief. Limit your input. Don't necessarily expect a rational discussion. Don't take words or actions personally. People with illnesses of this nature sometimes can take what you say quite literally. One mother said to her daughter, "Do you think you could make your bed?" The daughter said, "Well, I don't think about my bed at all." Or a daughter in this similar case might say, "Of course I could make my bed." That's the question that was asked. Better to say, "Please make your bed," if that's what you're trying to get to have happen. Say how you will feel if the person does what you are asking. "It would take a great load off my mind if you would take your medicine each morning." Avoid stockpiling resentments until some little thing causes you to explode. Rather, gently but firmly say when he doesn't clean up his dishes that you feel angry. Tell him that. "After you make a sandwich, I would feel better if you'd put everything away and wipe off the counter." Simple statement. You're telling what the person did, you're telling how you felt about it, and you're telling how you would like to have him behave in the future. This, people in general can understand. People with mental illnesses are often unable to clearly communicate what they need and what upsets them. So we need to pay close attention to their behavior and to their emotional state. There may be something they'd like to tell you, but they're just not able to tell you. There's such an enormous variation in individuals who have these illnesses that it's almost impossible to talk with you about it generally. Like a man I know who went in the hospital with a heart attack, and the doctor said, "Okay, tell me everything you felt." And then the doctor said, "Okay, remember those feelings, because that's the way you have a heart attack. If you have another one, it will feel the same way." That's the way he has a heart attack. It's not necessarily the same way that somebody else has a heart attack. Similarly, in each case of mental illness, it's unique. But there is a recognizable pattern for each individual. And if you get to know that pattern for the person that you're involved with, then you can intervene early when it's needed. Seeing someone that you love suffer from a major mental illness is frightening and painful. It's been known to shake people's faith in firmly held beliefs about religion and morality and the meaning of life. People can spend years trying to understand why these things happen or attempting to find some meaning in it or make some sense out of the situation. People lay in bed blaming themselves for not having done things differently in the past. In fact, if we had a nickel for every sleepless night spent by a relative of a person with a mental illness, we might have enough money to find a cure. It's hard to see a young adult struck down before they even reach their prime. Parents see their child's life becoming so much less than they wanted it to be. They've really, in a sense, lost the son or daughter that they once had. But yet, every time they see him, they're reminded of his previous potential. So there's a great sense of helplessness here. Family members have differing ideas about how to handle the situation, so that can create some stress. Major mental illness is an enormous loss. Dealing with all of these things, including the accompanying grief, takes more time than you would like and takes longer than you think it will and longer than you think it should. Mental illness is indeed an illness. We should see it as an illness and treat it as an illness. And you often just don't know how hard to push the person because you don't know what the person's capable of. You don't want to push harder than you should, but you just don't know. So you have to decide that you certainly cannot live somebody else's life for them. And any time I start wishing that I could live somebody else's life because I could do it better than they are, then I need to look at my own life and see how well I'm doing with living it, the one life that I can really do something about. Loving a mentally ill person is definitely an opportunity to learn and practice patience. Balance love and concern with a healthy dose of detachment and live in hope. One time, since I've already mentioned one movie to you that I'm not really in the habit of doing very often, but I was at Lewis Garvey's house. This may have been, 20 or 25 years ago. And he showed me a movie called Joe Versus the Volcano. It was a Tom Hanks movie. Meg Ryan was in this picture also, but she played three different girls, and it was a progression over time. Kind of an interesting movie. But there was one thing that jumped off that screen when I heard it, and it hit me in the face, and I've never forgotten it. The third girl that Meg Ryan was playing, they were on about her job was to take Joe to where the volcano was so he could jump into it and sacrifice himself as a human offering. But she got down in the lower portion of this boat where he was, and she was, in a moment, a flash of honesty, she was saying to him some true things about herself, and she made the statement, "I'm soul sick," which jumped off the screen at me from a Hollywood movie. I'm soul sick. We've been talking about a sickness that has its roots in physiology, but there is a soul sickness called sin. We've had at least a couple of lessons today that dealt specifically with that to a great extent. We're getting ready to extend the Lord's invitation one more time, and if you're outside of Christ, you are soul sick. On some level, you know that there's something wrong interiorly, and it's not going to be set right until the only remedy that can set it right, the blood of Jesus Christ, is applied to the problem and allowed to wipe out that sickness of the soul. If you are subject to the Lord's invitation tonight in any way, we ask you please to come forward to the front as we stand together and the invitation is extended. Please come if we can help.